We went into the village. There were no enemy there, just villagers, unit member Robert Miller told me years later. We went in to fight, but there was no enemy there. While some in the unit busied themselves killing livestock, others singled out a teenage girl and dragged her into a home. Miller saw the girl naked inside the hooch with a gun to her head, and Staff Sergeant Wilson Bullock remembered her screams. A short distance away, the medic Jamie Henry sat down to rest in a Vietnamese home, where he was joined by a radio man. On the radio, he heard 3rd Platoon Leader Lieutenant Johnny Mac Carter report to Captain Donald Ray that he had rounded up 19 civilians. Carter wanted to know what should be done with them. As Henry later told an Army investigator, the captain asked him if he remembered the op order, operation order, that had come down from higher that morning, which was to kill anything that moves. The captain repeated the order. He said that higher said to kill anything that moves. Hoping to intervene, Henry headed for Ray's position. As he neared it, though, Henry saw members of the unit drag the naked teenager out of the house and throw her into the throng of civilians who were squatting together in a group. Then, he said, 4 or 5 men around the civilians opened fire and shot them. There was a lot of flesh and blood going around because the velocity of an M16 at that close range does a lot of damage. It was all just another day in the life for Company B, albeit a particularly gory one. By the end of his tour, Henry said he knew of at least 50 civilians executed by our company, and with as little provocation as on the day of that massacre, not in the heat of battle or from air or artillery strikes, deliberate murder. The actions of Company B were hardly an anomaly. Hyenik Kwan, an expert on war crimes in the region, notes that at least 6 large-scale killings by Allied forces took place there during the first 3 months of 1968. In fact, his research shows that during this period, district communist cells reported 19 separate mass killings in Quang Nam to the provincial authority. One of these occurred just 4 days after the Company B massacre, when South Korean troops received isolated sniper fire near the hamlet of Phong Nhuat. In response, they launched a ground assault on the nearby village of Phong Nhi, many of whose residents had relatives in the South Vietnamese forces. When U.S. Marines and South Vietnamese troops followed on the heels of the Koreans, they walked into a horror show. One Marine took photos of the aftermath. Clumps of corpses, burned houses, a woman still alive whose left breast had been hacked off, a ditch filled with the bodies of women and children. Those villagers, he recalled, were all shot at close range or stabbed with bayonets. Tran Thi Duoc, a 16-year-old who survived the massacre, recounted how the Koreans had gathered the villagers and then gunned them down en masse. "I was too scared at the shooting site," she said, "and tried to stay still like I was dead. But one Korean soldier saw me, and I joined my 2 hands in front of my breast, knelt before him and begged for my life, but he shot at me." The shot blew off several fingers on Duoc's hands, and she lost consciousness. When she awoke, she found that her 2 brothers and both of her parents had been killed, and her 3-month-old sister had been stabbed with a knife or bayonet. In all, about 80 civilians perished in the bloodbath, and another 15 were wounded. One U.S. Marine stationed near Phong Nhi wrote, "Even we felt it was above and beyond acceptable bounds." But given the brutality exhibited by Americans throughout Quang Nam, what the Koreans had done was barely out of the ordinary. And in any case, the actions of the Koreans were hardly separable from those of the U.S. forces, since South Korean troops essentially functioned as American mercenaries. In its quest to internationalize the war, the Johnson administration provided funds to modernize the Korean military, helped cover expenses such as training, equipment, and the transport costs for bringing the Korean contingent to Vietnam, and paid a significant part of their salaries while they served there. On February 25, 1968, Korean troops entered Ha Mi, the hamlet where an American patrol had killed 23 fishermen the previous year, and herded residents into several locations. Some villagers were expecting food and candies to be handed out, but what came next was a slaughter that went on for 2 hours, leaving 135 people dead, almost all of them women, teenage girls, elderly men, toddlers, and infants. Only 3 of those slain were military-aged men. Later in the day, bulldozers arrived to scrape the entire area flat. 2 provinces southward, in Quang Ngai, Americans were carrying out a similarly bloody campaign. They regarded most of the province as hostile and hostile was how they acted in return. But friendly enclaves weren't necessarily spared. In July 1965, for example, after the revolutionary forces overran a government outpost in the majority Catholic village of Ba Gia, U.S. and South Vietnamese commanders decided, in the words of one U.S. officer, to unload on the whole area. Ba Gia was blasted by bombs, rockets, and cannon fire for 3 straight days. By the time U.S. and South Vietnamese ground troops entered the village, now a nightmare landscape of shattered stucco and torn-apart bamboo homes, the guerrillas had long since withdrawn. A reporter watched as 4 local residents carrying a pallet with a wounded man stared hatefully at American advisers accompanying the Vietnamese Marines. When asked about the number of innocents killed, the villagers bitterly replied, "Many." Afterward, a U.S. officer prophetically remarked, "There will be many more civilians killed that way as time goes on." The following month, U.S. Marines conducted a search-and-destroy operation in and around heavily populated villages on the Van Thuong Peninsula, which resulted in 688 enemy troops reportedly killed, but only 109 weapons captured. During the mission, the entire village of Van Thuong was obliterated, and numerous civilians were wounded. Indeed, according to a battalion commander, multiple villages were severely damaged or destroyed by napalm or naval gunfire, even though the military necessity of doing so was dubious. Another officer, though, saw no problem with the way that the operation had been carried out. In his after-action report, he recommended that, in the future, all hostile villages should be prepped with heavy ordnance, regardless of civilian casualties, prior to jumping off. Just as in Quang Nam, the devastating artillery attacks and aerial bombings pounding Quang Ngai took place alongside incidents of breathtaking brutality from American ground troops. One such horrifying event was vividly reconstructed from military records a few years later by Norman Poirier, a reporter for Esquire. A detailed magazine write-up of an atrocity case of this kind was unusual during the war, but the suffering chronicled in the article was all too typical. On September 23, 1966, Poirier related, a unit of Marines descended on Suen Noc Hamlet and began their rampage by breaking into the house of 61-year-old Wen Lu, a rice farmer and carpenter. They punched, kicked, and slashed the unarmed man while a Marine yelled VC at him. The intruders tore up his civilian ID card and wrecked his home. As Lu's young nieces screamed in terror, his nearly 70-year-old wife was manhandled and his sister mercilessly kicked. Soon after, the door to Nguyen Truc's home burst open. His wife bolted for their 5 children, but the Marines grabbed her and shoved her out the door. The 38-year-old rice farmer was then beaten until he could no longer stand. Next, 2 Marines grabbed him by the legs and held him upside down, while another delivered a devastating kick to his face. Shrieks and sobs filled the air. The screams reached the home of 16-year-old Wen Ti Mai, who took shelter in the cellar with her mother and aunt. As the 3 cowered in the basement, the Marines peered in and motioned for them to come out. The 2 older women obeyed, but Mai froze in fear. A hand reached in, grabbed her leg, and yanked her out. The Marines tore up the women's civilian ID cards. Then one of the Americans grabbed Mai around the neck and clapped a hand over her mouth. 2 others grabbed her legs, threw her to the ground, and roughly tore off her pants. Busting into 5 or 6 more homes in similar fashion, the Marines terrorized the hamlet without finding any weapons or contraband, or even a single piece of information about the enemy. Then they smashed into the home of 18-year-old Bui Thi Huang and her 20-year-old husband Dao Quang Tin, a farmer too ill to serve in the army. Their 3-year-old son also lived in the hut, as did Tin's mother, his sister, and her 5-year-old daughter. The Marines accused Tin of being a VC and beat him nearly unconscious, then propped him up against the front of his home next to his terrified sister and mother and the 2 young children. Huang was dragged to the side of the house. A Marine held his hand over her mouth. Others pinned her arms and legs to the ground. They tore off her pants, ripped open her shirt, and groped her. Then the gang rape began. First one Marine, then another, 5 in all. Huang's sobs elicited more screams of protest from her husband, so the Marines began beating him again, after which a burst of gunfire silenced him. Her mother-in-law's sobs ended soon after another staccato burst, and her sister-in-law's after a third. Soon Huang could no longer hear the children. Then came a crack and a blinding flash, followed by searing pain that brought her to the ground. The Marines exploded a grenade to make the scene look good, then radioed in their results. 3 dead VC, but back at the command post, they told their lieutenant that the shootings had not taken place at the prearranged ambush site and that some civilians were accidentally killed. The officer had the men bring him to the hamlet and saw the carnage for himself. Though he was shocked by the killings, the lieutenant formulated a plan to cover up the crimes. Tin's body was dragged to the originally planned ambush site half a mile away, and the Marines faked a firefight there. They also doctored up the massacre site in Suan Noc. When they lifted the naked, blood-streaked body of Tin's 5-year-old niece, the child cried out. Somehow the girl had survived the shooting, but Private First Class John Potter saw to it that this time she wouldn't live. He told the other Marines to count and kept time mashing up and down with his rifle, according to a fellow unit member. Another recalled, "I said 1, 2, 3, and he was hitting the baby with the rifle butt." The Marines did not notice that Bui Ti Huang was also still alive, though unconscious from a gunshot wound. When she awoke hours later, in severe pain and soaked in blood, a neighbor helped get her to a U.S. Marine base for treatment. There, Huang informed a Vietnamese interpreter about her rape and the massacre of her family. He in turn relayed the information to a sympathetic American doctor, who verified that she had been sexually assaulted, then went to the battalion commander and reported the crimes. If Huang hadn't survived the massacre, remained unconscious during the Marines' return, been brought to the base, and spoken to a courageous interpreter who found an American officer who intervened on her behalf, it is likely that, as with so many other massacres, the events at Suan Noc would never have come to light. Even with her testimony and a subsequent official investigation, 3 of the 9 Americans involved in the massacre were found not guilty, and 4 others received only short jail terms. Less than a month after the rape and slaughter at Suan Noc, on October 19, 1966, U.S. and Korean troops arrived in Dien Nien Hamlet. Some of the locals fled in fear, but many stayed to protect their homes and belongings. The Allied forces searched the homes and herded local people at gunpoint into a large group, where they sat in the sun in a state of extreme fear well into the afternoon. At about 3 p.m., the first shots rang out, ripping into the civilians. Some bolted for their lives but were gunned down in nearby, partially flooded rice paddies. The boots of pursuing soldiers pressed the faces of the wounded into the water, drowning them. Many other villagers simply froze and were torn apart by gunfire. Several bodies fell on top of V.T. Nguyen, and the tiny woman lay still, feigning death amid the blood and gore. After the troops left the hamlet, Nguyen stood up and saw that the area was filled with corpses. Among those who did not run away, she was one of only 2 survivors. A monument in Dien Nien lists 112 civilians killed in the massacre. A similarly horrific scene played out in nearby Phuoc Binh after South Korean troops arrived there on November 9, 1966. The younger men of the hamlet, who were regularly targeted by Allied military forces, fled to a nearby South Vietnamese army base, leaving only women, children, and old men behind. "The Koreans killed our livestock for food without asking or paying for it," recalled one female resident, "but otherwise the situation was calm for 2 days. Then, on the 3rd day, the soldiers began rousting the people from their homes and calling them VC. The woman grabbed her children and fled. When local men returned to Phuoc Binh a week or so later, they found only bodies. The villagers had been shot in front of their homes or killed by grenades inside their houses, and the hamlet had been burned. A monument to the massacre in Phuoc Binh lists the names of 68 victims, most of them women and children. Yet another massacre took place on December 6, 1966, when Korean forces killed 200 people in An Phuoc hamlet. Overall, South Korean troops reportedly committed no fewer than 14 massacres in Quang Ngai in 1966. Kim Ki-tae, a Korean officer, offered a matter-of-fact description of one of these bloodbaths. "We'd pushed 29 unarmed youths aged between 20 to 35 years into a bombing pit and shot them all to death." For Vietnamese villagers, perhaps the most unnerving thing about American and Korean patrols was the unpredictability of the soldiers' behavior. In Nonhua Hamlet, a villager named Phan Van Nam explained to me that sometimes U.S. troops handed out candies. Sometimes they shot at people. Sometimes they passed through a village hardly touching a thing. Sometimes they burned all the homes. We didn't understand the reasons why they acted in the way they did, he told me. Nam and other villagers described how on March 22, 1967, Nonhua was visited by Korean troops and a couple of Americans. It was anyone's guess what the outcome would be when they collected a group of villagers together until the soldiers opened fire. 86 of the 88 people there were killed, including 45 children, 30 women, and 11 elderly men. Only two old women survived. That same day, another 18 people were killed at a separate site nearby. Throughout this time, heavy aerial bombardment and artillery strikes continued to pound Quang-ngai as well. In the spring of 1967, elements of the 25th Infantry Division engaged in a series of fierce battles, utilizing helicopter assaults to surround a fortified village and then employing artillery and airstrikes to destroy the enemy and his fortifications. In just 3 months, from May through July 1967, the division fired over 42,000 artillery rounds into the provinces Duc Pho and Mo Duc districts. Supporting units fired yet more artillery rounds, which, Army documents boasted, added great depth and power to the H&I program of the brigade. A high-ranking officer told the New Yorker correspondent Jonathan Schell that while 20,000 villagers had moved to refugee camps, an estimated 52,000 of them were still living in areas of Duc Pho targeted by harassment and interdiction fire. In nearby Mo Duc, when Schell asked a pilot about the people who had lived in the district's bombed-out areas, he was told that there was no need to worry about them. All the personnel that were down there were pretty much VC. An official 25th Infantry Division report similarly insisted that 80% of the people of Duc Pho were communists or communist sympathizers. Such attitudes help explain the string of atrocities reportedly committed in the Duc Pho-Mo Duc border region in the spring of 1967 by Charlie Company, 2nd Battalion, 35th Infantry, under the command of Captain James Lanning. These included the killing of civilians and unarmed prisoners, as well as mutilation of corpses and burning of villages and crops. At least some of the acts were allegedly carried out on orders from higher commanders. In May 1967, according to sworn testimony given to an Army criminal investigator, Lanning, while leading troops, ordered the execution of a wounded detainee. Radio man James Stockdale remembered the incident as a straightforward command from Lanning. Get rid of him. At that point, another officer helped put the wounded prisoner in a boat, pushed it into a flooded rice paddy, riddled the man with bullets, and then tossed a grenade into the boat. According to Paul Halverson, a soldier and military combat correspondent who accompanied the unit, such outright cold-blooded killings of prisoners and civilians occurred repeatedly. Sometimes one or two people were gunned down, sometimes more than 10 at a time. On one occasion, Halverson saw the soldiers cover a wounded woman with a straw mat and set her on fire. This deliberate killing of non-combatants, he said, was cold-blooded murder. When asked about the total number killed by the unit, Halverson stated, "The entire time I was over there, just by Charlie Company, I'd say it would be in the hundreds." According to Army documents, Halverson saw Lieutenant Gary Myers gun down an elderly VN, Vietnamese man, who had surrendered and was unarmed. In Halverson's words, he looked like he was in his 80s. He came up with his hands in prayer fashion. He was bowing. But Myers, Halverson recalled, commanded, "Shoot him." When Halverson wouldn't do it, Myers raised his rifle up, took aim, and shot him in the side of the head. Unit member Richard Port likewise remembered non-combatants killed for expediency's sake as an alternative to taking prisoners or detaining people. It was easier to dispose of them, he said. It happened all the time. Meanwhile, another unit member, Sergeant Lonnie Gentry, recalled that it was commonplace for the soldiers to fire on anyone who ran, including, on one occasion, a boy about 8 years old. Of course, the practice of shooting children and other non-combatants just because they ran was by no means confined to Lanning's company. After returning to the United States, David Bressam, who had been a helicopter co-pilot with B Troop, 1st Squadron, 9th Cavalry Regiment, told Army investigators about seeing the results of one such incident near Duc Pho. One day in the summer of 1967, Bressam said, he noticed from his helicopter three or four bodies lying in a field, among them a dead Vietnamese boy of about 10 years who still held the halter of a cow in his hands. Radio conversations then informed him that there was a body count of 33 people in the field altogether, of which a third were military-age males and the rest were women and children. They had been spotted taking evasive action, that is, trying to run across the open stretch of land, and that had justified the deaths of all of them, male and female, young and old. This was not an isolated occurrence. In public testimony a year later, Bressam testified about one particularly egregious incident. We flew over a large rice paddy, and there were some people working in the rice paddy, maybe a dozen or 15 individuals, and we passed a couple of times low over their heads, and they didn't take any action. They were obviously nervous, but they didn't try to hide or anything. So we then hovered a few feet off the ground among them with the two helicopters, turned on the police sirens, and when they heard the police sirens, they started to disperse, and we opened up on them and just shot them all down. Even flimsier pretexts for killing were often employed by other troops. At around the same time as Bressam's helicopter missions, the Tiger Force, a 45-man reconnaissance platoon of the 1st Battalion, 327th Infantry, 101st Airborne Division, was carrying out just such a string of wanton atrocities. In one typical incident, which took place near Duc Pho in early May 1967, Tiger Force members took a prisoner, tortured him, forced him to run, and then gunned him down. The next month, in the same area, another prisoner was bound, tortured, and killed. A Tiger Force trooper executed a teenage boy and cut off his ears, and another reportedly killed a prisoner by slitting his throat. In the Song Ve Valley, the Tiger Force soldiers killed an elderly villager and planted a grenade on his body. As the months wore on, the platoon's murders mounted. On July 28th, Tiger Force troops opened fire on a group of unarmed elderly farmers, killing four of them. Separately, that same day, they executed two elderly blind men. Toward the end of the summer of 1967, Jonathan Schell flew over the ravaged Song Ve Valley in a forward air controller's plane. Defoliants had killed the vegetation, and nearly every home had been destroyed. The 101st Airborne Division was to blame, said the pilot. When Schell asked an Army information officer about what he had seen, he was told that U.S. troops didn't destroy that valley. Questioned further, the officer clarified his statement. There had been no plan of destroying the valley, he explained, but after VC were spotted there, we inserted two battalions back into the valley, and then it got destroyed in the process of denying it to the enemy. Villagers who survived the American assault lost not only their homes, but also their rice and cattle. Jammed into a refugee camp, one woman lamented, "They bring us here and spill us onto this dry land. They give us some rice and some corn, but not enough for us and our children. Now our children are dying. Soon they will all be dead. We are thrown here and left to die, and when we die there is no one to provide funeral clothes or coffins for our burial, and we are buried like dogs." Some of the refugees soon began sneaking back to the Song Ve Valley to brave life in a free-fire zone. The dangers of trying to live in Song Ve and the surrounding area were enormous, a point made vividly clear in August 1967 by the Screaming Eagle military newspaper, which proudly noted that the 2nd Battalion, 320th Artillery, had recently fired its 250,000th artillery round from a mountaintop overlooking the valley. The bombardment left the region's rice paddies pockmarked with craters, while homes all around were burned and battered. Schell tallied up the effect of American tactics on Quang Ngai and its people. From the air, he wrote, the roofs of houses that were still standing appeared as dark brown squares. The ashes of houses that had been recently burned appeared as gray squares. And the rain-washed clay foundations of houses that had been destroyed more than a month or so earlier appeared as red or yellow squares. When houses had been burned by troops on the ground, their walls of clay and bamboo or stone were usually still standing, but the walls of houses that had been bombed or bulldozed were flattened or strewn over the rice fields. The pattern of destruction was roughly the same throughout the densely populated area of fields and villages lying between the mountains and the sea. Using such aerial surveillance, military maps, and interviews with U.S. ground commanders, Shell was able to compile comprehensive statistics about the level of destruction. In Quang Ngai's Binh Son district, for example, he found that aside from a belt of untouched houses along a main road, 70% to 80% of all homes had been wiped out all the way to the sea. In neighboring Son Tin district, some areas had suffered even more. He made the obvious point, although it was a truth seldom expressed at the time. The war in Quang Ngai, as in many well-populated areas of Vietnam, was a battle less against enemy forces than against the South Vietnamese people. Even a conservative formula developed by a Defense Department analyst put the number of civilian casualties in the province each year at 33,000. Other sources put the figure at 50,000. A secret inquiry into Shell's findings, commissioned by Ambassador Ellsworth Bunker and conducted with General Westmoreland's consent, would confirm the carnage, but the inquiry would never be made public. Mr. Shell's estimates are substantially correct, the report admitted, though it claimed that there were some very important political and military reasons for the scope of destruction in this area. Those reasons all boiled down to the fact that the majority of the people of Quang Ngai supported the National Liberation Front, not the South Vietnamese government. Meanwhile, American troops in Quang Ngai came and went. The Tiger Force, for instance, moved by the late summer of 1967 into neighboring Quang Tin province, where it would continue its string of atrocities. But no matter which particular units were operating in Quang Ngai, the brutality against civilians never abated. In a series of letters home to his parents in late 1967 and early 1968, Specialist Leslie Lantos lamented the way that the men of Alpha Company, 2nd Battalion, 35th Infantry, mistreated the people of Duc Pho District. "I have always been disgusted with many things that take place out in the field, such as rape and degrading and humiliating old villagers," he wrote in one note. And in another letter, Lantos admitted that the unit's actions did not stop short of murder. "I've seen innocent people killed simply because someone wanted to kill a gook," he wrote. Lantos's company was hardly alone. On the evening of September 4, 1967, for example, members of the Company C, 1st Battalion, 35th Infantry, under the direction of Platoon Sergeant Otis Redmond and led by Lieutenant Donald Cinnamond, found themselves traveling along the shores of An Khe Lake near the hamlet of Dien Truong. The soldiers had spent the afternoon in the hamlet conducting a civic action program, during which they'd shared a hot meal with the villagers and passed out candies and soaps to local children. Now they were moving from the village to a nighttime defensive position. As the soldiers proceeded along the lake, they spotted two boys from Dien Truong in a sampan. The youngsters had been sent fishing by their father as the GIs left. The troops were directed to fire over the children's heads in an effort to force them to return to shore. Sergeant Redmond, however, took aim and shot directly at one of the boys, wounding him. The second boy rushed the boat toward the shore, but as he reached the shallows, Redmond shot again, killing the wounded youngster and then his brother. The two boys were called in as enemy KIAs. A few months later, another innocent fisherman in the province was similarly killed by U.S. forces. As Sergeant Michelle Pagano related to an Army investigator, in December 1967 or January 1968, he'd watched an infantryman take aim at an old man fishing in a lake near the village of Sa Huynh. The soldier told Pagano that a captain at the nearby base had seen the fisherman through binoculars and said, "Get him." With his M16 on automatic, recalled Pagano, the soldier fired an entire clip of ammunition at the old man. The man fell out of his boat into the water. The captain at the base, Pagano told investigators, was Ernest Medina, the commander of Charlie Company, 1st Battalion, 20th Infantry. The shooting witnessed by Pagano was not an isolated incident for Medina's Charlie Company. In January 1968, a patrol by members of the company spotted two Vietnamese fishermen in boats in the same lake. Lieutenant Michael Lowe, the officer in charge, apparently radioed in to ask for instructions. Medina's response was terse. "You know what to do with them." One of the fishermen, an Army investigation concluded, was shot and killed instantly. The other was wounded and swam to the shore, where he was finished off by a soldier. Both, according to testimony, were unarmed civilians. A month or so later, according to witnesses, members of Lowe's unit were sent into a village with a mandate for murder. In a sworn statement to investigators, unit member Thomas Kinch described how the mission unfolded. Lowe told us that when we got to the village, we were to shoot everyone, including women, children, and old men. After we were on the patrol, he changed the order to kill only young men. When we arrived at the village, I walked around the corner of a hut and came upon a man repairing a fishing net. I told this man in Vietnamese to get out of there. He just looked at me and smiled. I then heard Lowe on the other side of the hut, so I called to Lieutenant Lowe and told him that I had a young gook. Lowe replied, "You haven't killed him yet." That's when I pulled the trigger and shot the man. He fell backwards off the stool he was sitting on and laid on the ground moaning. I looked at the man I had shot and then walked away. Another unit member then killed the wounded man on Lowe's orders. The body was mutilated by a medic and called in as an enemy killed in action. As the days went on, the situation in Charlie Company continued to degenerate. As one soldier put it, first you'd stop the people, question them, and let them go. Second, you'd stop the people, beat up an old man, and let them go. Third, you'd stop the people, beat up an old man, and then shoot him. Fourth, you go in and wipe out a village. On March 14, 1968, after a booby trap killed one soldier and severely wounded two others, members of the unit went on a rampage through several hamlets. They beat up a villager on a bicycle, assaulted children, and set upon an unarmed woman. They shot and wounded her, one GI wrote in a letter home to his father later that day. Then they kicked her to death and emptied their magazines in her head. 2 days later, the men of Charlie Company carried out the massacre at My Lai. While members of Charlie Company were herding terrified villagers into the infamous drainage ditch, the men of Bravo Company, 4th Battalion, 3rd Infantry, were sent to the nearby coastal hamlet of My Khe. Like the soldiers who entered My Lai, Company B encountered no enemy forces as they approached. In fact, peering through heavy brush and trees, the Americans saw only civilians, mostly women, children, and old men, going about their household chores. Nevertheless, Lieutenant Thomas Willingham had his two machine gunners pour preparatory fire into the enclave. When the machine guns stopped, the Americans entered the hamlet. As Willingham's radio man, Mario Fernandez, was in a position to see everything his commander did. According to Army documents, Fernandez said that the point team, the first men into the hamlet, indiscriminately sprayed the area with rifle fire. Then the rest of the unit entered the village, and Willingham gave orders to destroy it. Infantryman Homer Hall said that they moved through the village grenading bunkers without checking to see if civilians were sheltering inside. They just threw it in there without calling them out, agreed unit member Jimmy Jenkins. According to Fernandez, when Vietnamese did come out from the bunkers, they were shot. Some guys picked out a woman and two kids, Jenkins recalled. They squatted down, and I watched two guys cut them down. Other villagers were gunned down while attempting to run to safety. As one soldier put it, it was like being in a shooting gallery. Infantryman Donald Hooten, according to an Army report, killed an unidentified Vietnamese boy by shooting him in the head with, presumably, a .45 caliber pistol. One witness from the unit later told Seymour Hirsch what he saw that day. "I remember that the baby was about 10 feet away, and he fired at it with a .45. He missed. We all laughed. He got up 3 or 4 feet closer and missed again. We laughed. Then he got right up on top of him and plugged him. By this time," said one unit member, "the word was out. You know, like you more or less can do anything you like." An American who kept count said that 155 people died at My Khe, and an official U.S. Army investigation found no reliable evidence to support the claim that the persons killed were in fact VC. Ron Reidenauer, who later exposed the My Lai massacre based on accounts he collected from other soldiers, witnessed his share of atrocities firsthand while serving as a helicopter door gunner in Quang Ngai. On his first combat mission, Reidenauer saw the other door gunner on his chopper, who had been instructed to fire in front of a fleeing and apparently unarmed Vietnamese, accidentally shoot the man instead. The pilot got on the radio and called an officer on the ground to check out the wounded man. "The officer gets there, runs up to him," Reidenauer recalled, "stops, leans down, looks at him, stands up, pulls out his .45, cocks it, boom. He shoots the guy in the head." At least 6 or 7 times in his 4-month span with the helicopter company, which lasted through April 1968, Ridenour saw similar scenes unfold below his hovering aircraft. We'd say, okay, here's someone who's looking suspicious or whatever, and some infantrymen would walk up to him and just shoot him. I mean, no provocation. I'm talking about murder. Over the course of those 4 months, Ridenour's unit killed about 36 guerrillas. In the 8 months prior, another unit had worked over the same area and claimed 700 to 800 kills. What that said to me, Ridenour recalled, since we were out doing the same thing, in exactly the same area, was that they were just out there killing a lot of people. They were being a lot less discriminating than we were about who we were engaging. What Ron Ridenour witnessed from his helicopter and Jonathan Schell observed from a military plane, what Army medic Jamie Henry and Marine Lieutenant Philip Caputo saw on their patrols, what villagers like Bui Ti Huang and Vi Ti Nguoi lived through in their hamlets, that is the essence of what we should think of when we say the Vietnam War. While we have only fragmentary evidence about the full extent of civilian suffering in South Vietnam, enough similar accounts exist so that roughly the same story could have been told in a chapter about Binh Dinh Province in the mid-1960s, Hien Hoa Province in the late 1960s, or Quang Tri Province in the early 1970s, among others. The incidents in this chapter were unbearably commonplace throughout the conflict, and are unusual only in that they were reported in some form or recounted by witnesses, instead of vanishing entirely from the historical record.